From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The 2026 election cycle is already well underway. In recent months, we've seen a rash of names announce their intent to run from everything from governor to Congress to sheriff. To help us understand how this election cycle is already shaping up, we turn to Rebecca Gill. She's an associate professor of political science at UNLV. Also with us is Michael Schaus. He's a political commentator and opinion writer whose work often appears in the Nevada Independent. Rebecca, Michael, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Thanks.
Rebecca, I want to start with you. Obviously, we are a little less than 11 months away from voting, but the ads have already started. Candidates are already throwing their names into the hat. So what are you keeping your eye on this election cycle?
This is a really good question because a lot of what we're going to see this election cycle, we're not really sure about yet. So what we have to do is sort of anticipate some of the trends. I think one really interesting trend here is that we have a really big increase in nonpartisan voting here. And there are some structural reasons for this. But I think this makes it very interesting to try to get a handle on how people in Nevada are feeling by party and how these party primaries are going to turn out.
Michael, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the same thing. I think the huge increase in independent voters, some of which is because of the automatic registration at the DMV, but also a lot of people feel kind of politically homeless, so to speak, in today's weird political environment. So it's interesting because that makes it really hard for the parties to get a feel of what the general election is going to look like. They might kind of know where their base sits, but, you know, the support of your base doesn't always translate into wide, broad Democratic appeal.
You know, there's no big Senate race this year. I think that's one of the marquee things in this election. So the top of the ballot will be the governor's race. Right now, it seems to be between three people, incumbent Republican Joe Lombardo, who should have no problem making it past the primary. However, the Democrats, Attorney General Aaron Hill, Ford and Washoe County Commissioner Alexis Hill will have to duke it out. Rebecca, what are you looking at in that primary?
That primary should be pretty interesting. And what I am seeing so far, I mean, polling at this point in time is difficult, right? Because what we're seeing is that a lot of people are still unaware of who these people are, right? People are pretty clear on who Joe Lombardo is because he's the sitting governor. But I think there's going to be an interesting ramp-up period where the candidates in the Democratic primary are going to have to introduce themselves or reintroduce themselves to the statewide electorate.
Of course, Nevada's election is not happening in a vacuum, and what happens in D.C. rarely stays in D.C. So, Michael, from your perspective, what impact do you think President Trump and his agenda will have on this year's election?
Yeah, I think already people are a little tired of just the chaos that, you know, they reintroduced to the White House there. And so Republicans definitely have a liability going forward because everything from affordability issues. Yes, inflation has kind of been held steady at relatively low levels, but retail prices are still climbing. You know, there's a lot there that gives people anxiety. And when that happens, the incumbent party in Washington is blamed. And that tends to trickle down a little bit. So I think the challenge that Republicans have is kind of getting beyond that. The challenge that Democrats have is they do need to be more than just the non-Trump candidate. And so they really have to kind of flesh out their ideas for folks because I think people are, like I said, feeling a little, I don't know, politically disenchanted right now.
To that effect, we've seen Governor Lombardo do his best to walk a fine line when it comes to the president. On paper, he seems supportive of much of the president's agenda. However, it's not the deep-throated support we hear from folks like Nevada's GOP chair, Michael McDonald. Do you think the governor has done a good job of keeping Trump and his administration at arm's length, Michael?
For the most part, yeah. I think he's done pretty good at showing that he's certainly a Republican. He's certainly going to be supportive overall of Republican priorities. But he has certainly gone to lengths to say, hey, I'm still independently minded. I am not necessarily part of that Trump coalition, even if I have thrown some support his way. And I think he's done a pretty good job, and that reflects so far, I think, his job approval numbers with Nevadans, which has maintained pretty high levels throughout his tenure. So I think he's done better than some other Republicans, whether or not that still maintains as things go forward and more stories pour out of Washington. We'll see.
You know, we are still in the primary phase. We haven't even gotten to candidate signups yet, but we are in the technical primary stage. You know, do you expect any sort of primary challenge to the governor?
I would be a little bit surprised. And I am the only reason why I'm surprised is because even within the dysfunctional GOP inter-party politics, generally, if there's a popular governor or popular incumbent, they don't really want to rock the boat too much. So I would be surprised if there was a real serious challenge there. And any challenge that's going to come up probably won't have the sort of teeth that some of the more far right wing folks would actually like.
As I mentioned at the top, there's no big Senate race in Nevada this year. In previous non-presidential elections, we've seen those Senate races bring a lot of attention, a lot of money. Without those high-profile races, though, should we expect to see lower voter turnout, Rebecca?
I think that's possible. And I really think a lot of that is going to have something to do with what ends up happening in national politics. One thing, even though Nevada is very difficult to poll, because a lot of Nevadans are still undecided about, you know, kind of these more state and local races, people do have a very strong opinion about President Trump. And as his fate goes, so tends to go the fate of Republicans. And the closer we get to those elections, the more we're probably going to see, you know, the Democrats throughout, you know, from top to bottom of the ballot, attempting to tie their opponents to Trump. And so depending on how strongly people are feeling around the time of the election, even without these big marquee races, we may well see, you know, reasonably strong turnout, particularly since we have, you know, several cycles under our belt with this all-male balloting, which really increases access and makes it a lot easier for people to participate this way.
Despite the lack of a Senate race, the state's four congressional seats are once again up for grabs. Of course, control of Congress is perhaps the biggest prize in these midterm elections. At this point, Rebecca, do you see any of Nevada's representatives as appearing vulnerable?
I don't think so just yet. I mean, I think right now, you know, obviously, there is likely to be a disadvantage for Republicans across the board, across the country. A lot of that having to do with just the fundamentals of, you know, the first term of a presidency. That president's party tends to lose seats. But in our situation, we have one Republican incumbent who is in a very safe seat. So I think that would be maybe where some weakness could lie. But in this case, I think that's probably pretty doubtful.
Republicans have largely targeted CD3 in recent cycles. That's currently held by Susie Lee. The district includes much of the western half of the Las Vegas Valley and the southern tip of Clark County. Michael, why do you think it's been so hard for Republicans to flip that seat in particular?
I think it goes back to really getting a handle on what Nevadans want. I mean, we're an interesting, very kind of independent, unique purple state. And I say that with a lot of pride because look at the last couple of election cycles. Yes, Donald Trump won the vote here, but also, you know, abortion access was a key issue as well. So was voter ID. I mean, you have this really kind of weird mix of issues that appeal to both the left and the right. And so it's hard for political campaigns especially to get a feel on where exactly those purple voters are. And just given the nature of our very divisive politics right now, when you've got a party base that is very, very pro, in this case, pro-Trump in the Republican Party, sometimes they kind of lose sight of, oh, yeah, those middle voters that we're actually going to need when we get to the general.
I'm glad you mentioned abortion and voter ID because, Rebecca, there are already two questions that are going to be on the ballot, which seemed attracting two different, very different kinds of voters. Of course, you have the amendment that would make abortion a constitutional right and the other that would put voter ID requirements in the state constitution. Is there any evidence out there that shows ballot questions actually bring voters to the polls?
There has been historically. It's a little bit tricky in this particular situation, particularly with the abortion issue. And I say that only because, you know, it did pass with, you know, nearly 2/3 of the vote last time. But we already have this protection in state law, and not just in any regular state law, but it was put in using this kind of direct democracy process the last time. So it's not something that can just be overturned in one go by the legislature. And so when you have the situation where we already have these protections, but we just want to be extra sure. It's hard to get people, you know, particularly motivated to turn out for that. It's usually once there is a real, actual, palpable threat to that issue that can drive people out.
You know, one thing that we haven't talked about in this conversation is issues that are likely to arise from this election. Of course, pocketbook issues such as the economy, the rising cost of housing, medical care, those are going to be top of mind for most folks. What else do you think is going to come up during this election, Michael?
Well, I mean, I think, again, going back to national issues kind of trickling down to the state level, things like immigration are going to have to be talked about by both parties, honestly. It's one of those, certainly people expected some immigration enforcement when they elected Donald Trump, but also at the same time, the way that this enforcement is playing out certainly doesn't seem to be what a lot of people thought was actually going to happen. So I think Democrats are going to see that as an advantage and bring it up, and Republicans are going to have some answers for that on the state level. They're going to have to either express support or kind of trepidation over how it's playing out. So that's going to be one that comes up, even though it doesn't directly necessarily have to do with state politics.
Rebecca, simple yes or no question. One narrative we've seen play out in times, last few elections, is the widening gender gap. More women are voting for Republicans, more women are voting for Democrats. Is there any reason to believe that trend is going to change anytime soon?
I doubt that that trend will change. The way things are looking right now, it's very likely that we're going to see this gender gap continue.
And that is where we're going to have to leave it for now. However, I think we're going to be having a lot of these sorts of conversations over the coming months. Rebecca, Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just to the west of Nevada's boundary are the towering Sierra Nevada mountains. The granite peaks themselves tell the story of geologic time, but the forests and creatures that live in those mountains tell us another story, one about survival. In recent decades, the Sierra has faced an increased threat from wildfire, drought, and invasive species, a deadly combo that's only getting worse with climate change. To better understand the impact of climate change on the mountains, a team from the University of California, Davis trekked up some of the highest peaks in the range with the goal of finding high-altitude Jeffrey Pines, whose presence can reveal much about a warming planet. Here's that story.
What are we listening to?
That sound you're hearing? It's a Clark's Nutcracker, a bird that lives high up in pine forests, like in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
And it sounds like we're hearing several of them. They sound a bit like crows or obnoxious scrub jays in my backyard.
Yeah. A UC Davis bird biologist described it to me as a raven holding its nose.
That's a great description.
And these birds just might be reshaping part of California's forests.
Reshaping. Okay, so what do you mean? How does a bird do that?
The Clark's Nutcracker has a habit of burying pine seeds, caching them in rocky slopes as winter food. Some of those seeds sprout, becoming trees.
Well, that makes sense, but how can that actually reshape parts of forests?
Scientists are now learning that certain trees are showing up in places we wouldn't expect them, in extremely high elevations, places that previously would have been frozen or inhospitable to them.
What kind of trees are we talking about?
We are talking about the Jeffrey Pine.
Okay, so I'm terrible at identifying trees. Like, if it's taller than me, it's a tree. If it's smaller than me, it's a bush, probably. Basically, there's two pine trees, right? There's the kind that look like Christmas trees, and then there's the Jeffrey Pine. Mm-hmm. And the Jeffrey Pine stands out to me. Do you know why?
Why?
Its orange bark smells like butterscotch. Sometimes people say it smells like vanilla. I think it smells more like butterscotch.
I kind of thought root beer.
Root beer?
I'm probably wrong.
But what other tree can do that? I ran across a lot of these while on the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada mountains. This was a while ago, back when I could go up mountains. And there are a lot in the Inyo National Forest. And they're also in Yosemite. I went backpacking there once, and we would stop and smell the bark. Yes.
You got to do that in life.
I don't think we were very high up on the mountain, though.
They're typically found between 5 and 9,000 feet in elevation. It's the most common tree found around Lake Tahoe, Mammoth Lakes. It's not even considered a traditional subalpine tree species. These are the ones that live at the highest elevations. But about a year ago, UC Davis forest ecologist Hugh Safford stumbled upon a Jeffrey pine at 12,657 feet in elevation at Sequoia National Park. It was the highest Jeffrey pine ever recorded, and it was the highest tree recorded in California.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, not only the highest Jeffrey pine, but the highest tree in California is a Jeffrey pine, and it's not even supposed to be a subalpine tree species. And he just knew that the Clark's Nutcracker played a role in why it was there.
It was really clear it was a nutcracker. I confirmed it with the real experts, but that wasn't a question anymore. But the question was, what the hell is this thing doing here? And why are they caching this particular species up here? And how is it surviving up here?
Hugh vowed to return to the high peaks of the Sierra to look for more Jeffreys.
And you obviously got to go along with him.
I did. Well, for 4 days, with him and his lab students in the Inyo National Forest. This was just a tiny fraction of the time Hugh ultimately spent on the mountains this summer. All told, they camped 30 days, scoured 24 mountain peaks, and hiked 240 miles to find these things.
That's amazing. Like, why? I mean, that's a lot.
Yes.
That's like a real lot.
That's a lot.
And why on earth would anyone want to risk life and limb, no pun intended, actually pun totally intended.
Yeah, you're like
but
that.
But like to look for a tree.
Well, because they're ecologists and they love that stuff. But also it's because of what these trees' presence might reveal about our changing climate.
Okay, so these trees, the ones living where they weren't expected, are kind of like sentinels, right? Or indicators. They tell us about our shifting climate.
Yeah. So, yes, with rising temperatures, snows melting earlier, trees are possibly moving upslope, maybe with help from a little bird. Hugh says if you want to understand what's happening with climate change, you have to look at Earth's extremes, like the poles and the mountains.
And we'll talk about your climb to those extremes in this episode of Unfold. Coming to you from UC Davis, this is Unfold. I'm Amy Quinton.
And I'm Kat Kirtland. Following the team wasn't just a stroll through green, shady forests, although it did start that way. When you get to high elevations, there are a few scattered pine trees and some gorgeous alpine lakes and meadows. The landscape is also a vast expanse of cream-colored rocky crags and huge, pretty intimidating boulder fields.
Yeah, how did that work out for you?
I mean, it was gorgeous, but it was also daunting. I mean, I'm kind of a flatlander, one living in the super flat Central Valley, no less. Being that high definitely felt out of my element sometimes. There were days we would hike 10 to 12 miles just to get to where we thought we might find a Jeffrey pine.
Oh my God.
Yeah. We went up Mount Langley. This is a 14,000 footer and California's ninth highest peak. This is where we'd hope to find the highest Jeffrey pine.
And did you?
Nope.
Oh, God.
Well, we found several on the trip, just not at Mount Langley.
Were they what you expected to see?
Well, they're short, for one thing. Even the adults are just a few feet tall, not like 100 feet tall like some Jeffrey pines can be. They were often damaged either by cold or by critters, and they'd just be growing there, poking their green, bushy little selves out of a rocky enclosure near the mountaintop.
So once the team finds a Jeffrey, what do they do?
They measure it.
3.3.
That's it?
Log its coordinates, check its condition, and many of these Jeffreys have no cones. Sashi Srivastava, a UC Davis master's student who led the field work with Hugh, says few high elevation Jeffrey pines do.
Life up there is hard, like nothing really. Nothing's doing its very best.
That might change with a warming planet, but for now, Hugh says many of these Jeffrey pine seedlings are not all that excited about being there.
This is way above where they want to be. It would be like taking someone's child and dropping them off in Greenland. You know, hey, you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it.
Oh, my God. That's hysterical. I mean, it's sad, but it's hysterical. The trip sounds so grueling, and you get up high, and you see these little bitty things struggling to survive. I mean, why not use modern technology, AI, remote sensing, satellites, rather than trekking 240 miles over the summer?
You know, we talked a lot about that, especially on the last night of the journey. You have to groundproof it. Hugh explains why modern technology, while super helpful, super powerful, it just doesn't provide the full picture of what's happening at these elevations.
You can't see these baby Jeffrey pines from satellites. It's impossible. We can't even barely see them walking by them. You know, you saw a bird serendipously caching. Well, a machine's gonna pull that off?
You saw a bird caching, so burying its seeds for winter. I guess this brings us back to the Clark's Nutcracker.
Right. So let me set the scene for you. Actually, I'll let UC Davis bird biologist Mike Mahoney set the scene.
We are currently on Joe Devil Peak, Devel, and we've been working our way slowly upslope looking for Jeffrey pines, and we've heard Clark's Nutcrackers the whole morning, and we had at least a couple of them on the lower slope.
But then suddenly, Mike goes still and alert. He's like a bird dog looking up at the sky.
He sees a Clark's Nutcracker.
Not only does he see one, but he sees one drop its cache. So he beelines it for the cache. And as he's digging for the seeds, at least six nutcrackers begin to call loudly, like they were launching an emergency action plan. Here's what it sounded like. And by the way, it was a windy day. One flies so closely over us, you could hear its wings.
It was aware of our presence, and I mean, if I were to assign a feeling to that bird, I'd say it was not so happy with our appearance. And it's kind of interesting, as we left the area, the birds have dispersed.
Yeah, it sounded not happy at all.
Definitely not. But those caching behaviors are key to understanding why Jeffrey pines are appearing so high up, where conditions used to be too harsh. Hugh says climate models make assumptions about how species will move with increased warming, but how and why a species moves is complex. Clark's Nutcrackers might have been storing Jeffrey pine seeds in their mountaintop refrigerators for millennia.
We forget that there are species that have the capacity to just leap over these boundaries, you know, and that's hugely important. If you want to keep up with climate change, it's true that trees that are just dropping their seeds in the wind are maybe, the wind is maybe moving them, you know, a few yards or something, you're not going to be able to keep up. But a species like Jeffrey pine or a species like whitebark pine or a species like limber pine, birds can move them 5, 10, 15, 20 kilometers without that much effort.
And that is exactly what these scientists are seeing. Seeds once buried by birds, now, because of warming temperatures, earlier snowmelt, are taking root.
So climate change isn't just pushing species uphill, it's allowing these leaps into new zones. So these birds are basically accidental reforesters.
Yeah, I kind of like to call them gardeners. And they've done that for whitebark pine for a really long time, but their role as gardeners of Jeffrey pine is something we're just beginning to witness.
So climate change, tree migration, and bird behavior all tied together. So I have to ask, though, do you think those isolated Jeffrey pines are a glimpse of what our future forests could look like? Or will they adapt to look more like their downslope ancestors?
You know, I can't predict that. But Nick Parker, an undergraduate on the trip, he had a keen observation on our last night.
It was so cool today seeing those, like, tiny little Jeffreys just, like, way up there. You know, there was like no other Jeffreys around, like just seeing how small they were and how, you know, imagining how far they must have come from the source. It's just like crazy to think how they got there. Yeah. And it's cool. I feel like I don't spend enough time appreciating like saplings.
So what do these scientists plan to do with all the data they collect on these little saplings?
Yeah, this is where more of that modern technology comes in. They plan to combine all their data with all of the verified global records to create a big database that climate modelers, natural resource managers, and really anyone interested in Sierra Nevada trees can use.
I have to say, it's created a powerful image in my head, trees sort of surviving in a place that's just not quite right for them.
Yeah, and whether it's right for them or not, you know, they're there. I can't help but wonder if they know what they're doing and are exactly where they need to be. It all shows how much effort nature and the people studying it put into adaptation. Hugh's team carried heavy packs, hiked miles at high altitudes, all to find these few small pines that may tell us how forests will evolve in a warming world.
It's a reminder that understanding climate change means going to the extremes, sometimes following a bird.
Exactly.
And Kat, I know you took some gorgeous photos and created watercolor sketches of what you saw along your hike, and you've written a marvelous and much more in-depth story to go along with it.
Well, you can see all of that and find links at our website, ucdavis.edu/unfold, or at ucdavis.edu/climate. I'm Kat Kerlin.
And I'm Amy Quinton. Thanks for listening. And definitely check out those photos. You're awesome.
Remittances, the money sent by migrants living in the U.S. to help sustain their families back home, can often be a lifeline. But a new tax that just went into effect on the new year may change how much they're able to send. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Alejo Cruz has more.
Inside El Super, a line begins to form in front of their financial center. Here, people can pay bills, cash checks, but most importantly, send money to family in other countries. Across the Americas, millions of families rely on money sent by migrants working in the United States through funds known as remittances. But now, new U.S. policies around migration are attempting to shake up how that money moves and who's getting it.
Cada 15 días mando dinero. Igualmente también para mí, o sea, yo lo deposito a mi cuenta y desde aquí yo hago mis pagos que tengo pendientes allá y así.
Meet Susana. Every 15 days, she sends around $200 back to Mexico, an amount that's been steadily increasing over time. Susana was granted political asylum in 2023, and remittance transfers have shaped her life for the past year and a half.
Sí, estoy arreglando un local que tengo allá, y pues pago mi seguro de vida porque yo tengo un seguro de vida allá en México.
Besides helping her family, Susana has been funding the repairs to the land she had to leave behind, along with investing money into her life insurance in Mexico, a necessary precaution she is taking out of fear that something could happen to her. Susana isn't the only one increasing the amount being sent back home.
You see a declining migration and an increase in remittances, and the only explanation is that the people who are sending money are sending more.
That's Manuel Orozco, director of the Migration, Remittances, and Development Program at the Inter-American Dialogue. Orozco interviewed migrants to better understand the growing remittance flow in Latin America. Take Nicaragua. In the first half of this year, remittances rose by 22% compared to last year, a $350 million increase. What's driving this increase? Fear of deportation.
There is a sense that in case they get deported, if they get deported, they'd rather send as much as they can now so that their relatives can be covered, considering that once they are deported, they won't be able to continue to send their money.
Remittances are by no means a new phenomenon. They are one of the biggest foreign capital inflows, supporting the economy of many developing countries. But this isn't the first time migrants have been threatened with a remittance tax either. Paul Vaylor, professor at the University of Minnesota, specializes in migrant remittances and entrepreneurship in developing countries.
And we have many instances in the U.S. that we can look to as examples, mostly at the state level, where certain states have tried to tax remittance transactions, is they just go underground again.
States like Oklahoma have threatened to curb remittances by imposing a fee on transfers that can be reclaimed via an income tax credit, something undocumented immigrants cannot do.
So you can see the same policy intent here. It's to single out and, some would say, punish migrant transactors who are less likely to be well-documented.
Vaylor believes this tax will not generate any significant revenue and that a potential decrease in regulated remittances next year won't necessarily mean the money flow has slowed down.
Migrants are incredibly intelligent, and they're incredibly self-interested when it comes to getting money home to the people they love in their communities. They'll find a way around it.
Back at El Super, Susana echoes that determination.
Aquí la vida está muy, muy, muy fría, muy fea.
She says life in the United States has been very cruel since her arrival.
Yo vine con un propósito acá, o sea, y no pienso tampoco quedarme a vivir aquí, o sea, no. Únicamente unos años y ya me voy a regresar.
Susana came to the United States with one goal in mind, to send money back home. Her refugee status has given her the privilege to work, and she intends to work for as long as she can, even if it means having little money left for herself while in the U.S.
That story was produced by Alejo Cruz with our sister station KUNR in Reno. If you're like me, the period after the holidays tends to be very low-key. It's still a little too chilly to play in my garden, so I like to sit back and enjoy a good movie. And luckily for me, the Oscars recently released their short list of potential nominations just a few weeks ago, with the rest due this weekend. So as movie season comes to a head, we thought it was a good time to check in with our resident film expert, Josh Bell. Josh is a freelance writer and movie TV critic based in Las Vegas, the former film editor of the Las Vegas Weekly, and a current Desert Companion contributor, whose reviews also air weekly on KTNV Channel 13 in Las Vegas. Josh, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
The biggest local film or filmmaker story of the year might just be the wide release of The Long Walk, based on Stephen King's novella that local writer, director, and Freakling Brothers horror show creative director, co-writer J.T. Molnar adapted. You know, you picked that film as your number seven film of 2025. Many other critics have praised the movie as well. Why did it resonate so much with you, and how much do you think Molnar's screenplay had to do with your opinion of the movie?
I think the screenplay is a huge part of it. It's based on a Stephen King novel that I personally was a huge fan of back when I was a teenager, and I think in my teenage mind had a very clear sense of how this should be made as a movie. And for me personally, they did an excellent job of adapting this dystopian story about a walk to the death, essentially, for these characters into something that is resonant today. And I think that's a reason why so many other critics liked it as well. It is unfortunately a timely story about an authoritarian government that uses this spectacle to distract the public from terrible things. But also it has this kind of retro-futuristic style to it that I thought was really appropriate for a novel that was written in the 1970s and originally as an allegory for the Vietnam War. And so I think Molnar's screenplay captures exactly what it needs to kind of balance that between those original intentions and something that's relevant for current audiences.
The film was one of many wide releases that actually underperformed, despite that critical, reception at the box office last fall. Does horror have the type of fan base that can give an initially lesser watched movie a second life on streaming rental?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, horror, although this movie may have underperformed at the box office, horror has been one of the most reliable box office performers and home viewing performers, I think, over the past 5-10 years, because it does have a very devoted fan base. These films are generally cheaper to produce than bigger action spectacles and things like that. And so I definitely think, I don't know the numbers exactly in terms of home viewing for The Long Walk, but horror fans and Stephen King fans are very, very devoted. And I think this is a movie that people will continue watching, that as it shows up on streaming, people will discover maybe it's something they didn't think they needed to see in theaters because it was about a bunch of dudes walking and it didn't have a lot of big explosions and special effects in it. But absolutely, I think the genre overall and this movie specifically will continue to find an audience.
Las Vegas also appeared in the blockbuster 2025 film F1. And Las Vegas filmmakers Bobby and Renee Peoples made 8 feature films last year. What were other local hallmarks of feature film scene in 2025?
Well, I mean, I think F1 is a huge deal, and we should acknowledge that that's, seeing all that stuff on the big screen is a major thing. And the Peoples are absolutely on the other end of that. They are just workhorses making these small, low-budget films. They made 8 feature films in a single year. And, I mean, in terms of local film, Jonathan Bowen, who is another Las Vegas filmmaker, released his comedy called The Comic Shop, which had cameos from Carrot Top and Murray Sawchuk. And a fun kind of... It's always nice to see local movies that take place not on the Strip. It was great to see F1 on the big screen, see the Strip on the big screen, but it's cool to see movies that take place within the town, and filmmakers like Jonathan Bowen and like the Peoples, they do that. These are films that take place in local businesses, in, local neighborhoods and things like that. Opposite of that, there was a sci-fi film called Absolute Dominion, also released this year from director Lexi Alexander, that was a big action sci-fi thing that was filmed at the Terribles Casino in Gene, which has been shut down, but a great location for dystopian nightmare cinema, apparently.
Gene, you heard it here first. In the documentary space, Las Vegas filmmaker Deborah Richards' release Shaken and Stirred about the flair bartending scene. And there were biopics of local personalities Danny Gans, Susan Powder, Sabu, and Vinny Favorito, released last year. Has Las Vegas been a good place for filmmakers, local or otherwise, to find people with good stories to tell?
Absolutely. I mean, and this is something I wrote about in an upcoming Desert Companion article related to those documentaries about Danny Gans, Susan Powder, Sabu, and Vinny Favorito, is that all of those people are what I think of as like the Las Vegas character, right? People who could only exist here in Las Vegas, who are famous as Las Vegas personalities. Maybe they wouldn't be famous elsewhere exactly. And I think there's tons of people like that. I love seeing movies made about these kind of people, whether they're entertainers on the strip or, a pro wrestler, a comedian, a fitness guru, people like that who just find a niche here in Las Vegas. And I could list, and I'm sure anyone, in the local media could list a whole bunch of other people just like that. I hope to see future documentaries about those people. I think Las Vegas is such a rich vein for documentary filmmakers to mine if they just look in the right places.
Josh, you don't just eat, drink, and sleep and breathe film. You're also a TV expert. Next month, there's a Netflix series debuting that's set in Las Vegas. Tell me about that.
That is called Strip Law. It's an animated series. And so not shot here in Las Vegas, of course, because it's just animated. And I will say I have not seen this show yet. I do not have super high hopes for it, but it does seem to trade on a lot of Las Vegas stereotypes, which unfortunately we get, especially from filmmakers and creators who are not from here, but it has an impressive cast, a voice cast that includes Adam Scott, Janelle James, Stephen Root, and Keith David. And it is about an uptight Las Vegas lawyer who teams up with a flashy female magician on the strip to solve cases, I guess. I don't know. We'll see how this goes.
Well, there's also another series coming later in the year that's also set in Las Vegas and stars Anya Taylor-Joy. What's that about?
Well, that I have slightly higher hopes for. That's called All Lucky. Right. That's going to be on Apple TV. It's based on a very successful novel by Marissa Stapley, which I have not read, but was a like Reese Witherspoon book club selection or something like that, I think. And Anya Taylor-Joy is great. She plays sort of a con artist woman who has tried to leave her criminal past behind. But of course, it comes back to haunt her here in Las Vegas. And the cast also includes Annette Bening and Timothy Oliphant. And it looks like some big production values. Again, I haven't seen this yet. It doesn't actually have a specific date to premiere other than sometime in 2026. But lots of higher hopes for that one versus the animated show.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't ask about the Jewish Nevada Film Festival, which starts January 24th. It dates back to 2001. What of note will be featured there?
They're showing a good lineup. You know, we just talked about documentaries, and that film festival has documentaries about Sherry Lewis, Charles Grodin, and Elie Wiesel among their programming. It's opening with Scarlett Johansson's directorial debut, Eleanor the Great. Scarlett Johansson will not be there, unfortunately. But yeah, it's a great festival. I mean, and it's interesting you said it goes back to 2001. This is sort of a second version of it. The original founder, Joshua Abbey, had left town a few years ago, but thankfully Jewish Nevada has picked things up and kind of created their own version of this long-running festival. So I'm really glad to see that going, because Josh Abbey is a longtime cinema supporter here in Vegas, and it was a loss when he left town, and I'm glad that somebody picked up his legacy.
Of course, it's not the only film festival on the horizon. What else are you keeping your eye on?
Well, we've got basically one of our biggest, most long-running festivals each month for the next 4 months, which is great. After January with the Jewish Nevada Film Festival, the Damn Short Film Festival in Boulder City is coming up in February, which is a really fun community event and a great showcase for short films. The Nevada Women's Film Festival will be in March, moving back to their original dates. That's at UNLV, another long-running festival. And the Las Vegas Black Film Festival is coming back in April. All of these major community events that are really great for the film community and anyone who is a film fan. And I think the people who run these events, and they're the ones who make film culture happen here in Las Vegas.
Josh, we got about 20 seconds left. If there's one movie, one TV show from last year that I should watch, what should it be?
Oh, God. Well, I will pick something super obscure. My number one movie from last year is a Canadian film called Universal Language. You can stream it right now, I know, on Canopy, at least. It's a very surreal, bizarre combination of Canadian and Iranian culture, and just fascinating and funny. Universal Language. Check that out.
Listeners can read Josh's writing about several of the films and filmmakers we discussed today in the pages of our city regional magazine, Desert Companion, or at his website, awesomemovieyear.com. Josh, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR senior producer Mike Privat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
We usually start off with something very cultural, an art exhibit, a play, a musical performance. I want to start with something that addresses something we're all thinking about right now, the weather. What can Nevadans do right now to make the most of the cold?
They can grab a coat and go outside. And if they're in southern Nevada, they should head over to the Spring Mountains. In my experience, not very many people actually refer to that area as that. So maybe I should say that the Spring Mountains include the more familiar Mount Charleston and the Lee Canyon Recreation Area. And I think it's a good time to head over there because typically, and maybe this played out for some of you over the holidays, the end of the year is not the best time to go there.
Yeah, anything around Tahoe when, you know, the ski resorts open gets really packed.
Yeah, and I'm wondering now that people are in the back of the swing of their regular life and routines, maybe it's a good time to head to your favorite snow play spot, ski spot, etc. As for skiers, it's a great time to revisit Lee Canyon in particular, which has been getting snow off and on for the last week or so. I think they're supposed to get some more tomorrow, Thursday, that is. And if you haven't been in a while, it's worth reminding people that the facility has gone through some changes over the last 5 years. The newly reimagined lodge looks great. The parking situation is vastly improved and expanded. I think there's something like 30, almost 30 ski trails to enjoy. There's now 5 lifts that are working. I should add that on the 10th, there's actually a special event up there in Lee Canyon. They're hosting a ski and snowboard race called the Chris Ruby Memorial Cup. Outside of that, just pick a day, go outside. If you need more info, we'll have links at kmpr.org.
Now let's get to the culture. I know that's what you're dying to talk about. There's a unique opera classical program in Las Vegas this weekend. What's going on there?
Well, first of all, it's free. Opera Las Vegas, and by the way, this is a 25-year-old plus organization. It's one of 2 opera companies in Southern Nevada. There is a free show this coming Saturday afternoon. That's January 10th. It's over there at the Windmill Library Theater, and they're putting on a tribute show. Now, tribute shows in Las Vegas, that's usually a very commercial endeavor, we'll call it. But outside the tourist corridor, you'll find these tribute shows that will highlight undervalued or overlooked music or musicians, or maybe just something other than the usual, you know, canon worshiping programs. And Opera Las Vegas is actually doing just that. The show is called Opera Legends in Black. It'll be 4 singers. They are both local and visiting. And they'll perform a narrated 60-minute program that basically tips the hat to 11 different Black opera and classical singer and composers. Just some names to throw out there who they're paying tribute to: Leontine Price, Marian Anderson, Scott Joplin, probably one of the more well-known ones of the bunch.
All right, those are names I recognize, but is this going to be music I recognize?
Yes, of course. It's going to highlight songs from the pioneering Black opera Porgy and Bess. Then it's going to highlight a few different interpretation of arias by European composers like Wagner and Puccini, to name a few. And they'll have some numbers from West Side Story. Anyway, you look at it, it sounds like a pretty great primer to African-American opera history. And again, that is January 10th.
And for our final recommendation this week, you want to highlight a nonverbal conversation?
Yeah, it's an art exhibit. It's called A Dialogue of Dust and Water. And when I saw that title, I was thinking, okay, this is probably an exhibit about Nevada or the desert, environment, you know, something along those lines. However, what it really means, according to the artist, this is local Tatiana Harbachuskaya, and apologies, Tatiana, if I have messed that up, is that her work is actually a visual conversation between her two favorite styles of painting, watercolor and pastel.
So it's more about contrast then.
Well, actually, Tatiana wants to show how they complement one another. The exhibit has about 40 paintings of Tatiana's favorite subjects, which include cats, plant life, various landscapes, and humans. Regardless of the medium, I took a look at some of them online, and they're all very vibrant. They're all detailed. And maybe the through line in her work is her brushstrokes, and also maybe the way she blends the colors together. Some of the works are kind of impressionistic, and others have remarkable definition. And that's not something you might necessarily expect in watercolor. If you're not familiar with Tatiana herself, she comes from Belarus. She now teaches and creates here in Las Vegas. She's won a lot of awards, and she continues to show her work all over the world. She is showing A Dialogue of Dust and Water at Left of Center Gallery through January 17th. Just remember that gallery is closed Sunday and Mondays.
And that is where we're going to have to leave it. That's all the time we have. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Paul.